You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Gregor Chisholm, our MLB.com Blue Jays reporter, and it's going to be an exciting week at the winter meetings coming up in a week. We'll look ahead to that, and we'll also look back at one of the more exciting winter meetings in Blue Jays history. It's going to be a big week maybe for Jack Morris as well, a former Blue Jay great. I want to start, though, with some more newsy stuff, Gregor, and one of those things is one of the goals of this team this offseason was to add depth to the middle infield. They've done that. They make a trade with the St. Louis Cardinals. They bring in Aledmys Diaz. Now, Diaz, people may remember the name from 2016 when he was fifth in the National League Rookie of the Year vote, started the season on fire, cooled off a little bit that year, and really struggled a bit in 2017. But what do the Blue Jays think they can get from Diaz going forward?
Yeah, I mean, they think there's a lot of upside here. I mean, it was interesting when Ross Atkins started the offseason by saying that his top priority was adding a versatile infielder, but it made sense at the time because of what the team has dealt with Troy Tulowitzki and Devin Travis. And here we are, the first major move that they make is getting that exact type of versatile guy that they were looking for. I mean, Diaz is coming in technically without a starting job, similar to what he was faced with the Cardinals this past season. But there's going to be an opportunity there for a lot of playing time because you know that it's only going to be a matter of time before Tulowitzki and Travis have to miss some time. It also could buy Travis a little bit more time at the start of the year if he's still rehabbing an injury from spring training. So he's really offers a lot of versatility with the glove, and I think really the offensive side is what the Blue Jays would really love to tap into. Whether or not he can get back to 2016 remains to be seen, but even a middle ground between 2016 and 2017 would be a pretty nice piece because this is a guy that the Blue Jays have under control for the next five seasons, and all they had to give up was a promising outfielder, but a guy who was still in low-level minor leagues in Class A. So it was really kind of a no-brainer for Toronto all around.
Yeah, it fits their needs perfectly, and like you said, they didn't give up much, so a nice move. The non-tender deadline was Friday. The Blue Jays non-tendering Ryan Goins, Tom Kohler. Any chance either of those guys could be back with Toronto on a different deal?
I think there's an outside chance that you could see Kohler come back. I mean, I think he's the type of guy who's probably going to have to wait a little bit longer into the offseason before he settles in with the team. I think a few things have to shake out before then. And, you know, I think that a return to Toronto is certainly a possibility. I mean, the Blue Jays gave him an extended audition this past year as a reliever, and I think that's the role that they could kind of see for him. Now, the question he's going to have to ask himself is whether or not he can find somewhere where he can go in and potentially compete for a starting job again. And if he can, he probably goes there. And if not, then there's a chance he can come back as a depth piece. Ryan Goins, I think his time in Toronto it has come to an end simply because, I mean, now you have a decent amount of depth up the middle, and something the Blue Jays couldn't say a couple weeks ago, but they got Gifton Gope from Pittsburgh, and now pulling this move for Diaz, it really kind of solidifies what they're looking for. And Ryan Goins, who was out of options on the contract before, kind of became a redundant piece, and that's why I don't think you'll see him back.
Shohei Ohtani, the great two-way player out of Japan. We spoke about him a good amount last week, and the Blue Jays' outside chances of maybe making a run. Well, those chances were indeed outside, as he did. The Blue Jays don't make the first cut. Ohtani has limited his list to seven teams that he will meet with. Toronto, not one of them. No surprise here, Gregor, right?
No surprise. I mean, it's kind of like buying a lottery ticket in a way. And I mean, just because you go out and buy a lottery ticket doesn't mean you start spending the money. I mean, it doesn't really change anything about how you prepare for your day. And this isn't going to change anything in how the Blue Jays prepare for the rest of the offseason. I mean, the fact is this team's still looking for a fifth starter. They're still looking for a corner outfielder. It would have been nice if they could have gotten both of those things and a rather bargain basement deal that Ohtani's going to get. But, you know, it's not in the cards. It does seem like he's got a preference for the West Coast, and even the Blue Jays aren't alone in this. I mean, if there's anything that the Jays fans can take a positive from all of this, it's that, you know, they might have missed out, but so did the Red Sox and Yankees, and those two teams typically are the type of organizations that players like this go to.
Yeah, and there seems like there's a good chance he may end up in the National League, which a lot of people didn't think was much of a chance going into this whole thing. But of the seven teams that are left, four National League teams, three American League teams, and it seems like he's going to meet with most of these teams this week and will probably have maybe during the winter meetings, maybe before or just after, we'll know where Ohtani is going to play his baseball in 2018. Okay, speaking of the winter meetings, The Veterans Committee, the Modern Era Veterans Committee, will vote for the Hall of Fame. And that's, of course, a separate vote from the overall vote. So it's players that didn't get in the first time through or front office members, that sort of thing. But from a Blue Jays perspective, Jack Morris jumps out on the list this time around. Of course, nobody has ever been closer to getting into the Hall of Fame on the regular vote and not gotten in, but that happened to Jack Morris. He's been waiting a few years now for this vote to come up. This is his next chance. We'll find out on Sunday evening. What do you think, Gregor, if you had to kind of make a guess as to how this could play out? Do you think Morris has a good chance?
I do think he has a chance. You know, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's just that what he would have had to go through the last few years, I mean, coming so close, it really is just remarkable how close he came and then not to be able to get in. And now you see this opportunity now. And I was someone who grew up in that era when I was a little bit younger of a kid, but when Jack Morris era, when he went to Toronto after that memorable run that he had in that 10-inning complete game with the Twins before that. And I mean, he was part of those, you know, that World Series team with the Blue Jays as well. I mean, you think of him, when you think of baseball, you know, in the 80s and 90s, Jack Morris is one of the top pitchers is what always comes to mind. And I know there's always been a lot of debate between old school and new school and you know, weighing the value of that. But to me, he was just a pitcher who kind of signified that era as well. And, you know, certainly Blue Jays fans have fond memories of him as well. He struggled a little bit in Toronto, but after such a strong run with Minnesota and then coming part of that World Series team, he'll always be remembered here. And I know there's going to be a lot of people north of the border hoping that that he does get in.
He got two rings from Toronto, of course, the back-to-back titles. He was a much bigger part of the first title than the second when he was injured, but still a member of those teams. Two of his four rings, also, of course, winning the famous one with Minnesota, and he was also great for that 1984 Tigers team. You look at the committee, it's a 16-member committee. I believe it's the same percentage, so you need 75% of the vote, so 12 votes out of 16. Paul Beeston is on the committee. That can't hurt, right?
You got to think that has to be working in his favor.
So you have that, and there are some other names I think that would help him out. So we'll find out on Sunday. And we must say, I guess, he is an MLB.com analyst and employee here. So it is a little tough for me because I've worked with him so much here to be completely unbiased, but, you know, kind of rooting for him a little bit because we do gotten to know Jack quite a bit over the years here as he's been an analyst here at MLB.com. All right, looking back through the winter meetings history, you have a story up on the site, Gregor, looking back on 2005 and what it meant for this Toronto Blue Jays team where they kind of went all in. It didn't end up paying off the way they would have hoped, but just kind of sum up that 2005 winter meetings and what the Blue Jays were doing where they kind of won the winter.
Yeah, you know, it's really, you know, a lot of people when they think of kind of historical stories for the Blue Jays with the winter meetings, they think back to 1990 with the Tony Fernandez trade for Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar, Fred Lucas in that deal as well. But the one that happened more kind of recently was another example where the Jays similarly kind of went all in. They went a different route. They was the kind of pursuit of A.J. Burnett. And at the time, I mean, the Jays had been an afterthought in that division for quite a long period of time, and they were no longer really a destination for free agents. And the team had also really severely slashed payroll in the previous years going into 2005. And 2005 marked the first time that ownership group Rogers Communications really kind of upped the payroll and gave then general manager J.P. Ricciardi some money to work with. But there was a lot of skepticism that he'd actually find some people who would be willing to be elite free agents and actually sign in Toronto. And there was a hot pursuit of A.J. Burnett over several weeks. Came to a head at that 2005 winter meeting. And it was really kind of the nitty-gritty details of the contract that were negotiated there that, paved the way to the deal. And one of those was it included an opt-out clause after year number three, which ultimately, helped the Blue Jays get him along with the inclusion of a fifth year overall. But, you know, he was able to secure that deal and ultimately led to him leaving town as well, because after 3 years, Burnett did go on to use that opt-out clause. But there was a lot going on with the team at that time. It was really kind of an all-in situation. And Roy Halladay and A.J. Burnett got the pair up together for the next few years, and kind of was not necessarily a successful era in Blue Jays baseball, but it was certainly one that's memorable, and it's one that all started there at the winter meetings.
Yeah, that next season, Toronto going 87-75, so a good season, but they finished 10 games back of the Yankees that season. All right, so that brings us to winter meetings 2017. It all gets kicked off, Sunday into Monday down in Orlando, Florida. Should we expect the Blue Jays to be somewhat busy? Is it going to be a quiet week for Toronto? What are you anticipating?
I think there's going to be a lot of rumors. I'm not necessarily convinced they're going to get something done quite that quick. But we're starting to see that market move a little bit now. So maybe all teams across baseball are going to get things done a little bit quicker here over the next week or so. I mean, the Blue Jays still have several things that they want to do, and they have a decent amount of money to spend. I mean, they're looking for that fifth starter. They're looking for a right fielder, and they're looking for a potential lefty reliever. And you're talking about a team that could have anywhere from about $20 to $30 million to spend this offseason. And if it's on the higher end, then, that's certainly enough to get one pretty significant piece. And then you'll still have enough money left over for a couple of nice secondary pieces as well. So the Jays really should be in the thick of it when it comes to not necessarily the first tier of free agent starting pitchers, but that second and third tier. Once guys start falling, I think you're going to see some movement there with the Blue Jays, and then same with some of the outfielders who are available as well. So, it does seem like the time where things are starting to move up a little bit, so it wouldn't shock me if the Jays break the mold that they've had recently, which is they haven't done much at the winter meetings. That could potentially be different this season.
Yeah, and if Ohtani makes up his mind before the winter meetings start, and maybe Giancarlo Stanton decides whether or not he wants to accept the trade before the meeting start, then things could really be wild, because it seems like we've been bottlenosed and nothing has happened so far in the offseason, but a lot of things are waiting to happen. It could all happen over the course of those busy 3.5 days in Orlando. That'll do it for MLB.com Extras, our Blue Jays edition. For Gregor Chisholm, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Brittany Giroli, our MLB.com Orioles reporter. Brittany, about 4 days to go, I guess, until the baseball world heads down to Orlando, Florida, Lake Buena Vista, to be more precise, for the 2017 winter meetings. Let's look ahead to those winter meetings from an Orioles standpoint. And obviously, they still have some work to do here in the offseason. Pretty much everyone does, because it's been a very quiet hot stove season so far. So when you look ahead to the winter meetings next week, what's the biggest needs for the Orioles? We've talked about starting pitching. Is that something they can start to take care of next week?
I think they can start to, Tim, but if you look historically, the Orioles just haven't been a team that has set the market, and they've been a team that kind of has hung back and wait. So certainly they're going to be involved in a lot of rumors. I'd be very surprised if they went home with a guy who you were like, yes, this guy is going to absolutely be in our starting rotation. I just think it's too early and not enough has happened yet to really set the market for those middle tier guys that they're after.
Yeah, one of the factors in that, I think, is obviously Shohei Ohtani. We talked last week about the fact that the Orioles didn't have a big or much of a shot at getting involved in the Ohtani sweepstakes, and that proved to be true as they were eliminated, as seven teams have reached the finals, I guess, for Ohtani's services. The Orioles not one of them. So he's one of the big chips, and then obviously there's some other guys like Yu Darvish is a big name, Jake Arrieta. Those aren't the guys the Orioles are expected to be in on. What type of starters on the market are the Orioles expected to be? Is it still the Alex Cobbs of the world, the Lance Lynn's of the world that they hope to be involved with?
Honestly, I really think that Alex Cobb would be a great fit. I don't know if he's kind of priced himself out of Baltimore, but certainly that next level down from those guys that you mentioned, the CC Sabathia's, Lance Lynn, even a guy like Chris Tillman, who I know fans don't want to see back, but him back on a kind of low-risk, high-reward type of deal. They're always looking for those kind of reclamation projects, so to speak. So they have some money to play with, but I don't see them going out and blowing it all on one of those top arms.
Obviously, we're in a situation here where for the Orioles, with some key free agents coming up after next season, this is a moment where it looks like they're going to kind of go for it here with Manny Machado and everybody. But Is there any chance that some team came along during the winter meetings and really blew them away with a crazy offer that we could see a stunning trade for the Orioles come the winter meetings?
I don't see them doing that simply because, Tim, this is their window. This is their last year. So trading a Machado or a Britton or any of these guys, then you kind of have to fill those holes. So I think what they're trying to do is hang on, add a few pieces, and feel like if our pitching is better, if the pitching improves, we can be a good team. I think that's kind of the mindset surrounding this club. I don't see any big blockbuster moves at all.
All right, the winter meetings are almost here for 2017, but I also wanted to take a look back through the past of Orioles winter meetings. You have a story going up on the site about 2003. It was a big splash kind of winter meetings for the Orioles as they signed Miguel Tejada. He was the 2002 MVP, and those winter meetings took place down in New Orleans, and really the Orioles made the biggest move in signing Miguel Tejada. Take us back to 2003 and where the Orioles were at that point and how that move registered on the radar.
Yeah, I mean, the Orioles just aren't a team that makes a whole lot of big moves at the winter meetings, but I think when you look back, certainly adding Tejada was probably one of their biggest moves. That was a winter where they were really serious about getting things done. Tejada ended up being a great sign, a great contract for them. They ended up bringing him back, of course, later in his career. Not as good of a move there, but that was part of a really busy offseason for them. So it was really kind of out of the norm. The only other year, I think, recently where they've been a little aggressive at these meetings, Tim, has been several years ago. I think it was 2010 or 11, that year that they ended up acquiring Mark Reynolds and J.J. Hardy. And those were also two bigger moves that year. They certainly gave up very little to get Hardy back. But all in all, most of the time, I think a lot of people get so excited about these winter meetings, the Orioles just end up coming home with a few Rule 5 guys. Maybe a better picture of, you know, where they slot in, what guys to go after. But really, this kind of sets the tone for the rest of the winter. It's not really ever been a four-day frenzy, at least in Baltimore.
That signing of Tejada was a six-year, $72 million deal. So back, you think the $72 million back in 2003, big-time money, a big-time contract back then. And you make a good point. A lot of times for most teams, the winter meetings is more about starting things, getting conversations going, continuing conversations from the general manager's meetings, which are about a month beforehand, and then things get done later on, especially for the Orioles, who have kind of in recent years become famous for making those February additions to the roster. So much the same to be expected here coming up in 2017. All right, let's focus in on the guys that are already on this roster. You have a couple stories, featurey stories on guys. Speaking of Jonathan Scope, broke out a little bit in 2017, kind of went from, I don't know if he broke out as much as the world just kind of realized how good a player he was, but a great season in 2017. What is his process for making 2018 even better, and how important is that for this Orioles team if they're going to contend?
Well, it's huge. I think he carried them through a lot of stretches last year when Manny Machado, Chris Davis, Mark Trumbo were all slumping, and certainly we talked about that window and some of these guys like Machado and Jones and Britton are going to be approaching free agency. Well, Scope is only 1 year after that, and you look at this Orioles team and what he's meant to them, and I think the consistency has been big. Even when he wasn't hitting home runs, you know, he paced this team. He had a lot of walks, and they're going to need that. We talked about their pitching being a big need. Another need is the really, in my opinion, this offense cannot be an all-or-nothing kind of offense, home runs or strikeouts. They've got to find a way to get more productive outs, and certainly Jonathan Scope is a great guy to look at and kind of model after. He's a guy who was the epitome of kind of all-or-nothing, really honed in this year on being selective, and you saw it reflect. I mean, he had career numbers not just in the power, but in his batting average and his hits and his walks and his run scored, total bases. So I think that as an organization, they really need to focus on that more. And he's a guy who you can say sort of did it the right way and matured and was able to get to that level. And on a kind of a more note that you don't really see as much, I feel like he kind of has developed into a leader a little bit more in that clubhouse because of how well he performed. And certainly, in my opinion, he's an integral part of the Orioles. If they're going to be good next year, they need a lot to go right. We know this. But they also need a healthy Jonathan Scope, and they need him to continue to to be that guy, especially him and Manny Machado together. I think it's a very young, dangerous infield tandem.
When players get within that final season of free agency, it becomes increasingly tough, obviously, for a team to sign them to any kind of extension as they see kind of that light at the end of the tunnel where they can allow everyone into the conversation. So you mentioned Scope now 2 years away from free agency. Are they going to make a run at trying to extend him and let him be a guy that sticks around when it looks like Manny Machado is definitely heading out the door at the end of the year?
Certainly, I think they have a better chance. But I agree with you. I think this is kind of the winter and the spring to do it. And you really haven't heard anything. You heard a rumbling the other day about talks, and then you heard that same report get shot down. And I think if you're the Orioles, you kind of have to focus on guys like Scope, who you maybe still have a chance to keep. And as you said, it doesn't look like Manny Machado is staying. But certainly signing his best friend, Jonathan Scope, to a long-term deal may help sway a little bit more the ball back to Baltimore when it comes to Manny and maybe keeping him in the long term. So it's something that I think should be a high priority for this team as they look forward. They don't have a whole lot of money allocated in the future outside of a big deal like Chris Davis. They should have some money to play with here. And if you look at Scope, just turned 26, really entering probably the best years of his career still in front of him. I just think, why not at least get those talks going?
One more thing I wanted to touch on with you, and that is Chance Sisko. Obviously, he got a call-up in September. He's a big prospect for the Orioles. Wellington Castillo has left the organization, so that opens the door, obviously, for Chance Sisko, and I think that's kind of been the plan all along. But how much pressure is there going to be on this guy for a team that would like to contend in 2018 to have a rookie, hopefully, if all goes well, stepping in and being a key cog as far as catching duties?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure. And I think the one thing that they've thought and the one thing he showed when he came up in September was that he can hit. And that's great. But we all know as a catcher, they really need defense first, especially a team that struggles with their starting pitching staff, a team that really took a big dip and played below average defense this past year for the first time under Orioles manager Buck Showalter. So certainly there's a lot of pressure on Sisko to continue to improve his receiving, being able to throw out runners at a higher clip. These are things that they would like to see more of. And as you said, Tim, he's going to get thrown in that fire. They have Caleb Joseph as well, who adds a nice defense-oriented guy to that mix. But this is going to be Chance Sisko's job to lose. He is that heir apparent, that catcher of the future. And that future is now. So he's going to have to take everything he learned from that short stint up in Baltimore, hopefully apply it to spring training, and really start to work with this staff, because if he's not able to help elevate this pitching staff, it's going to be a really long year in Baltimore.
All right. Well, next time we speak, Brittany, it'll be down in Lake Buena Vista at the winter meetings. It'll be an exciting time, and I'm sure we'll hear at least plenty of rumors surrounding the Baltimore Orioles. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Orioles edition. For Brittany Giroli, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Yankees reporter, Brian Hoke. And Brian, busy week for the New York Yankees, who have finally found the manager. I guess technically the rumors leaked last week, but the press conference was this week. And Aaron Boone is officially the 33rd skipper of the Pinstripes. And it was an interesting press conference, I thought, because there was some fan involvement, just showing you that we are in 2017. But did anything stand out to you other than the normal, hey, this is a manager introducing himself to the media and to the fan base? Did anything stand out to you in that press conference?
Well, I thought that Aaron Boone won the press conference. I thought he handled himself perfectly. I thought that he was calm, cool, collected, composed, everything that you thought he was going to be. And that shouldn't come as a surprise considering his television background. I thought that there would definitely be polish there, and handling the media wouldn't be a problem for him. He was so personable during his playing career and his time in the broadcast booth that I thought that should be an easy transition for him. I think the real challenge is going to start when he gets the players down in Tampa in February and March, and he's running spring training and getting assimilated with that and trying to find his rhythm and figure out who he is as a manager. But as far as something that jumped out at me, I think that what really stuck with me was Brian Cashman saying that Aaron Boone was not on their list when Joe Girardi was dismissed at the end of the ALCS. Aaron Boone was not somebody who was on Cashman's mind anyway. There were people they spoke to who recommended to Cashman and said, hey, you got to bring Aaron Boone in. You got to talk to Boone. And Cashman wasn't really sold on the idea of having a manager with no managing or coaching experience. So I think that speaks volumes about what Boone was able to do when he got in the room at Yankee Stadium to win everybody over. And Hal Steinbrenner said that there was some dissent about who their second and third choices were. The Yankees brought in six guys to interview for that job. But across the board, everybody was pretty much secure in saying that Aaron Boone was the number one pick. And that's why Hal Steinbrenner didn't ask Boone to even come down to Tampa. He just hired him almost sight unseen. So I think that that really stuck out to me. That said a lot, that you're willing to give the keys to this franchise to somebody who has never done it at any level. Obviously, he's got a Yankee history. He hits a big home run. Had a long playing career, but there's going to be a learning curve for Aaron Boone, so I think that the press conference was just the beginning for him.
Hal Steinbrenner was also on the record early on in the process of saying that he would have some concerns hiring a manager like Boone that didn't have any experience. When it came down to it, was this Cashman selling Boone to Steinbrenner, or did Boone do enough of that himself? And I guess that leads to the question, how much has Cashman kind of put himself out there and put the pressure on himself going with someone without experience?
Yeah, it wasn't Boone selling himself to Steinbrenner, because even though they bumped into each other outside the weight room at Yankee Stadium, it was a very brief conversation. Hal Steinbrenner said that, you know, he was aware of Boone's career just tangentially, but not really overly familiar with it. So I think that everything that happened came when Aaron Boone was in that conference room talking to not only Brian Cashman, but Gene Afterman, Tim Nehring, Dan Geis, Mike Fishman, all the guys who were in that room kind of looking at him with a skeptical eye. And he was able to convince them all that even though he'd never filled out a lineup card at any time in his life, he was ready to do it for the New York Yankees. So, it's a huge gamble for Brian Cashman, I think. I think that the easiest thing in the world would have been to plug Joe Girardi back in. I mean, you were one win away from the World Series, and I don't think anybody would have batted an eye at that. But it was clear to Cashman that investing another 3, 4, 5 years in Joe Girardi was not the best move for the franchise at this time. They were starting to get diminishing returns, they thought. I know that's funny to say when you're one win away from going to the World Series, but they look at these things on a basis of 3 or 4 years. So if you look back at the last 3 or 4 years, I think you can make a better case for why Girardi was out. And then it was a whole separate negotiation there to bring in Aaron Boone. So a lot going on there, a lot of different things. But I think that the important thing to remember is deciding that Joe Girardi had to go and hiring Aaron Boone were two separate things. They did not get rid of Joe Girardi to bring in Aaron Boone. It just kind of worked out that way.
It was a surprise to many over the last week that Shohei Ohtani didn't just not choose the Yankees, but they didn't make the 7 finalists that he would decide to meet with. Big reason for that, I think, is just the fact that the Yankees play on the East Coast. It seems like that was something that East Coast teams were kind of out of the running before it started, once we kind of learned what Ohtani was looking for. That said, time for the Yankees to readjust, move on, heading into the winter meetings, and go in a different direction, and that means that they still need to add a starting pitcher. So where now do they focus in on? Is CeCe in play? Is a guy like one of the bigger names out there, or an Alex Cobb? You know, what level of starting pitcher is this team now interested in adding?
Yeah, I think they had they felt pretty good about their chances to get Ohtani. I mean, this is a guy that they scouted all the way back to 2012. Obviously, Brian Cashman went across to Japan during the heat of the pennant race in August. So they were very serious about this. Ohtani's people said that the Yankees presentation knocked them out of the water. I mean, they did a really great job with that. But like you said, New York might not be for everybody. And what you're hearing is that he didn't want to come to a large market and didn't want to come to the East Coast. So you move on. Obviously, Ohtani would have answered that question at the back end of the rotation, but the Yankees have said that starting pitching is their priority. So I would expect to see them go a little deeper with negotiations with Sabathia now that the winter meetings are beginning. I know that the Yankees have touched base with his agent a couple times here already. I think that Alex Cobb's a guy who could be in play, too. I don't think you necessarily have to pick one or the other. The one thing that Hal Steinbrenner said at the press conference yesterday is the team has usually been pretty good about putting money back into the club when it comes off the payroll. And even accounting for the players who are going to get arbitration raises, the Yankees should have probably $25-30 million roughly to sink back into the 2018 payroll. So I think that gives you a lot of leeway when you're talking about a Sabathia or a Cobb or perhaps both of them. I think that you can anchor your offense around Aaron Judge, Greg Bird, and Gary Sanchez and feel pretty good about it. But pitching is the key to the kingdom, as Brian Cashman always says. And so that's where their priority is going to lie right now.
So that would be certainly one of the things we'll be on the lookout next week in Orlando, Florida, at the winter meetings for the Yankees chasing pitching. What else do you expect the Yankees to be involved in when we hear all of the rumors swirling around Orlando? And do you expect them to be able to make a big splash over the course of that week?
Well, Hal Steinbrenner did say yesterday they're going to be active in the free agent market. They're going to leave no stone unturned. Now, whether or not that leads to something, I guess we'll wait and see. But stranger things have happened. I don't sense that the Yankees have a whole lot to do. You know, this is a team that exceeded expectations last year, won 91 games. You would think that they could be even better next season. I think that a lot of people looked at last year as a rebuilding year where the kids were going to get their feet under them and get some experience. And for them to take the Astros to a seven-game ALCS, I think that exceeded everybody's expectations. So I would think that there's a good chance that this year, 2017, could be the Yankees' weakest year or the next four or five. So they've got a lot of talent coming through the pipeline. I don't think that they necessarily need to go out and re-sign a guy like Todd Frazier or Matt Holliday. Not hearing a whole lot of buzz about that. So I would expect them to – you're going to hear the Yankees linked to starting pitching a lot. Maybe you can upgrade the bullpen. Maybe there's a trade to be had there. Certainly Dylan Betances is a guy who I think could be on the move. Jacoby Ellsbury, you're going to hear his name come up. I'm not sure if anybody's going to take on 3 years and $68 million, but the Yankees should make some noise at the winter meetings, I think, but let's wait and see if they actually cross the line on any negotiations. I think that remains to be seen.
All right, let's take a look back on a previous winter meetings for the New York Yankees, and one that led, you could say, pretty much directly to a World Series title, and that is 2008. You have a story coming up on the site about that. The groundwork was laid, I guess. CC Sabathia wasn't into a contract during the 2008 winter meetings, but they were well on their way to that seven-year, $161 million deal in an offseason that also brought them to Shera. That winter meetings, while they didn't have the big press conference at the meetings, it was a huge winter meetings for a Yankees team that would go on to win the 09 title.
I'll never forget that winter meetings because that was the year that Brian Cashman disappeared from the winter meetings. They were being held at the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, and Cashman ducked out on a Tuesday afternoon. He'd been summoned to California. None of us knew about it at the time, but he was knocking on CeCe Sabathia's doorstep and sitting down in his living room with his wife and their three kids and kind of trying to sell CeCe Sabathia on what life would look like in New York. And just a West Coast guy, you know, so many years have gone by, and we think of CeCe in pinstripes now, but he was a West Coast guy, California-born, who had some hesitation to come to the East Coast. You know, he just finished a year in Milwaukee. He started his career in Cleveland. He was thinking maybe he'd wind up out West again and where all his friends and family were. And Cashman, I'd forgotten this part in doing the research. They met twice in Las Vegas that week because CeCe happened to be in town to watch a boxing match. And so Cashman was able to look Sabathia in the eye, kind of talk to him for 3 hours over those two meetings, and whatever they said was intriguing enough that CeCe said, hey, why don't you come by the house, you can talk to Amber, his wife, and we'll talk a little more about that. And when that invitation came, Cashman booked a flight and got out of there. So I do remember that Tuesday night, hearing late that night in the lobby that Cashman had left the building, and everybody was trying to figure out where he was. And by daybreak, the news had come out that not only had he gone to California to talk to CeCe Sabathia, but CeCe was in agreement now with the Yankees, and he was going to sign the richest deal for a starting pitcher at that time, or any pitcher at that time, 7 years and $161 million. So, as you said, it led to a World Series. I think that you look back at that 09 team, they signed Sabathia. They laid the groundwork to sign A.J. Burnett during those meetings. A month later, they signed Mark Teixeira. They had already traded for Nick Swisher. And there's your 2009 world champion New York Yankees. So definitely a big winter meetings in Yankee history for Brian Cashman and obviously for CeCe Sabathia, too.
it's amazing because you see so many years where teams win the winter and then fizzle once the season comes around. But that was a definite moment where the Yankees won the offseason and then won the World Series title. Pretty cool stuff. All right. That'll do it for MLB.com Extras, our Yankees edition. For Brian Hoke, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. We'll be at the winter meeting in Orlando, Florida.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Rays reporter Bill Chastain. On the podcast this week, we're going to look ahead to the 2017 winter meetings. We're also going to look back on the 2012 winter meetings, which were an interesting meetings for the Tampa Bay Rays. We'll touch on some other things as well. I wanted to start on the hot stove, which is warming up a little bit, Bill, not necessarily for the Rays, but all around. Shohei Ohtani has limited his list to 7 finalists. Unfortunately, the Rays not among those 7 teams, as we kind of anticipated and spoke a little bit about last week on the podcast. So he will be meeting with 7 teams and trying to figure out where he will end up for next season. As far as trade rumors with the Rays, it seems like there's still a lot of smoke about Colome and whether or not he'll get dealt. And he's a guy on that roster, right, that makes a lot of sense if the Rays are going to deal somebody. When you look at his contract, what he might be able to bring back, he seems to be a logical guy that they could move.
Yeah, and when you factor in the team's owner, Stu Sternberg, has, you know, kind of said they're going to lower the payroll this year, you got to look for ways to do that. And Colome is projected by a lot of people to make probably $5 million plus through arbitration. So, you know, if you do the math, he might be one of the guys that would be likely candidate to go.
Early in the offseason, we heard the Twins and Colome. More recently, there's been some reports about maybe the Cardinals. And then I saw one report by Jean-Paul Morosi of MLB Network and MLB.com. He mentioned that if Stanton falls through for the Cardinals, maybe the Cardinals would kind of broaden that trade and try to pull in Colome and maybe go after a guy like Evan Longoria. Now, obviously, that's a big name that draws some headlines. What would it take for the Rays to consider parting ways with really the guy who's been the face of the franchise for so long?
Well, I mean, first, I think it's going to be interesting to see which way they go. I mean, right now it's kind of looking like they are going to go, you know, I hate to use the word gut, but I would say reduce themselves significantly. I know they didn't, you know, they traded Brad Boxberger and, you know, that was that the first, you know, the precursor to other moves like that. Now, I do think Longoria is in another, you know, a whole nother realm as far as what the Rays think of him and how they value him. So I think it would take a pretty, you know, good chunk to get him. But by the same token, you know, he's coming up on his 5 and 10, you know, so, you know, if they were going to move him, it would look like they would want to move him before that came into being. But I do think it would take a lot because I think he's kind of viewed as the leader and kind of the heart of the team.
Yeah, and you mentioned 5 and 10. Of course, players who are 10 years in the big leagues, 5 with one team, have those full no-trade, they get the ability to have that no-trade clause in the contract. So, yeah, if you're going to trade him, it would probably have to be for that because he just feels like a guy that's comfortable with that organization, is happy to be with that organization. So with the possibility of scaling down payroll and rumors like this, when you look ahead to the winter meetings, which start on Sunday into Monday down in Orlando, Florida, Bill, usually the Rays are a fairly quiet organization at the winter meetings, doing a lot of talking, but not necessarily pulling the trigger on any big moves. Does this make it more likely that maybe they'll be more active because of the chance to deal away some contracts and scale down, as you put it?
And that probably depends on how far they got at the GM meetings. Historically, like you said, they have always just kind of put parameters for deals together and talked with other clubs about, you know, finding interest and, you know, to see if they had a match. And it always seems like, you know, it's shortly after the winter meetings when these deals come to fruition. So, you know, I imagine they'll be talking with everybody, particularly if, you know, I'm still waiting to see, like I said, you know, what their plan is for the offseason. Are they going to try and build around some of their veterans, or are they going to trade those guys and go to a totally, you know, youth movement? I don't expect them to go to the total youth movement. They've never done that. But, you know, when you try and guess what these guys do, you know, you can get brain freeze. So it'll be interesting to see which way they go.
It is interesting, too, because they do have team-friendly contracts on a lot of their big-name players. Longoria, you know, you'd save money by trading him, but he actually has a team-friendly deal. Chris Archer has a team-friendly deal. So I think you're right. It makes a lot more sense to maybe make some tweaks and try to catch some breaks and make a run with who you have if you can add the right pieces. You mentioned oftentimes they set up deals at the winter meetings as opposed to getting them done at the winter meetings. And that brings us to 2012, which was, I guess, an important winter meetings for this Tampa Bay Rays team. And one of the reasons is what you just said. They put together the groundwork for a big trade at the winter meetings that turned out to happen later. James Shields, Wade Davis, Will Myers, Jake Odorizzi. That big deal started coming together at the 2012 winter meetings.
And if you look at that deal, both teams won. You know, the Rays got the Rookie of the Year. They got Odorizzi for a longer time than what James Shields was. The Royals got James Shields, who really kind of, you know, has been credited for kind of getting them, you know, kind of helping a young team shape their mentality for a team that eventually won the World Series. So I think it was a win-win for both teams. But, you know, according to, you know, what we heard, the parameters for that deal were put together at those winter meetings. So, you know, they're not usually the team that makes the big splash at the winter meetings, but they are usually behind the scenes, you know, setting the table for what they might do.
In that same winter meetings, they also did get a deal done. They brought in Yunel Escobar. He acquired him for Derek Dietrich. Talk about that deal, because it feels like that was one where the Rays, when you look back on it, won that trade.
Well, I mean, Dietrich's done, you know, had a decent career for the Marlins, but, you know, the Rays got the good Escobar for at least a year and a half. And I say that because sometimes he could be a little bit flighty. But, you know, when you see him and he's playing well, he's really a talented player, and he really helped the Rays when he was, particularly that first year at shortstop.
So that's a look back at 2012, a memorable year as far as winter meetings go with this Tampa Bay Rays team. Last week on the podcast, Bill, we talked about non-tender decisions and the possibilities for the Rays, Adani Echevarria and Brad Miller, Jesus Sucre. All those guys ended up getting tender deals. The one guy that the team non-tendered was Xavier Cedeño, but it seems like, sounds like, they may be able to bring him back as well.
Well, they, you know, they certainly haven't burned any bridges on that, and it probably wouldn't be a bad move for Cedeño to sign back with them. They're familiar with his, you know, maladies. He's had some health problems the past two seasons. And, you know, who knows what kind of demand is going to be for him. But he is left-handed. And like the great Skip Carey once said, if Frank Tanana, when he was out there pitching in the mid-40s, if he was right-handed, they'd be calling him coach. So, you know, this guy, he's left-handed, and when he's healthy, he gets guys out. He's a great guy to bring in and you know, get that left-handed out.
Is the fact that they did tender contracts to Miller and Echevarria and Sucre, does that kind of support your thought that this is a team that does not want to necessarily tear things down? Because you could have gotten rid of those contracts by non-tendering those guys, but they bring them back and they can be valuable pieces. Or is it more a situation where they think maybe those guys have enough value that they could be trade pieces?
I think all of them have trade value if they do decide to go that way. I mean, Echevarria, we saw what he could do at shortstop. Miller's 1 year removed from a 30 home run season. You know, so, and Sucre, you know, he really came a long way last year offensively, and his value as a defensive catcher is pretty well known. So all three of those are valuable pieces. But, you know, they actually, you know, just like we were talking about Echevarria last week, if they, you know, decide to trade him, you know, you've got Matt Duffy, maybe Willie Adames comes in there. Same thing with Brad Miller. We're not, you know, even talking to Chaim Bloom the other day. He wasn't even sure quite where they were going to put Miller next year. You know, he brings him a lot of flexibility and plays shortstop, second base, first base, and the outfield. And even if he has struggled some with the glove, being able to play all those positions is, you know, there's certainly a value to that.
And I guess that also opens things up as to it. It kind of broadens the number of players that you can go after to fill holes, because you don't necessarily have to go out now and find a first baseman to fill the hole until Jake Bowers is definitely ready, because you could move Miller there and fill a different hole, right? It gives them more options for the rest of the offseason.
Totally.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting. We'll see if maybe in Orlando at the winter meetings next week, if this Rays team can have some fire to go with the smoke and maybe pull off some deals. We'll certainly see. That'll be the next time that we get together to record this podcast. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rays edition. For Bill Chastain, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week.
Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Red Sox reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, the winter meetings right around the corner. We'll be down in Florida next week. We'll be doing this podcast in person for a change. Looking forward to that. But let's look ahead a little bit because this offseason continues to be kind of stuck, it seems. But there's reason to be hopeful for the winter meetings because there are some reports out there that Shohei Ohtani and Giancarlo Stanton may make up their minds by the end of the week. And if those two guys find teams, then the winter meetings could be crazy. A lot of things could happen because that may kind of open the doors for a lot of other stuff. So from the Red Sox standpoint, because they seem to be, well, they're officially out on Ohtani and they seem to be out on Stanton as well, it's back to what we talked about before those guys. And from you, we've heard all along that you think J.D. Martinez eventually is going to be the guy. Do you think that could get done at the winter meetings, or is that going to take a long time before Scott Boras's client kind of figures out a team?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what price Scott Boras is looking for compared to what teams are offering. I mean, if there's a big gap, it could go on for a while. So you know how it goes with Scott. It could go either way. Yeah, I think J.D. Martinez makes a lot of sense just because he's a right-handed bat who Dave Dombrowski is very familiar with. Straight cash transaction. You don't have to worry about trading prospects. You don't even need to forego a draft pick to get J.D. Martinez because he wasn't extended a qualifying offer from the Diamondbacks. But also look at Eric Hosmer. That could be another guy they look at. He's got a winning pedigree. He's a very good first baseman, left-handed hitter. In Hosmer's case, a better positional fit because that's the position they need to fill right now is first base. So I would say I think the Red Sox will come away with one of those two guys this winter, and I agree with you that the Stanton thing and the Ohtani thing is sort of serving as a bottleneck, and once those guys are off the market, you know, things will move along.
I think a lot of Red Sox fans would say, why would we want Eric Hosmer while he's a great first baseman and he's a good hitter, not a real power hitter? The Red Sox, do you think there's a thought there that the power is still going to come? He hit more homers last year than he has, and maybe in a smaller ballpark, Kansas City, obviously a pitcher's home. Is there a thought that he could hit for more power? Because in his career to this point, he hasn't been that guy.
Yeah, you know, I don't think so. I think the power thing is a little over-dramatized. Because, like, the Red Sox were last in the American League in home runs last year because a lot of guys dipped below what you expect them to hit. But, you know, good hitters are good hitters. You have nine good hitters in your lineup. You know, I don't care if they're hitting home runs or not. That's going to translate to a lot of runs. And Hosmer's a guy who has a nice stroke for Fenway Park, goes to the opposite field. His swing would play well there, much like it does for Andrew Benintendi, who's not a huge power guy, but sometimes those 20, 25 home run guys, if you have those throughout your lineup, you're going to come up with enough power. And just the home runs were so over the top in 2017. I don't know if it was the baseballs or what, but I'm not sure that's going to continue again next year. So I think that, like I said, I think that people are, worrying too much about the power. And I think the Red Sox are just looking right now at getting as many good hitters as they can rather than looking for a guy who's definitely going to hit 35 or 40 homers.
Obviously having a great first baseman to help as well. They had that with Mitch Moreland a year ago, who swung the bat well until the injury, and you would think Hosmer would swing the bat even better. All right, let's look a little back in the annals of winter meetings past. One of the big ones for the Red Sox, and you're writing about it on the site, Ian, is back in 2000, where a lot of money was spent in that offseason, and the Red Sox were right there in the thick of things. Manny Ramirez was signed officially, 8 years, $160 million back at a time when $20 million a year was a huge amount of money. It's still a lot of money, but we see more and more of those contracts now. But it's an interesting deal because you think back on Manny's 8 years and all the money they spent on him, and he earned every penny of it, I think.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a wild ride with Manny Ramirez. And, crazy that was 17 years ago that they signed him. And people forget it was right after the Alex Rodriguez signing with the Rangers for 10 years at $252 million. It was like hours later, maybe the next day, when Manny signed his deal with the Red Sox, and you know, it was the first time the Red Sox had ever signed an elite free agent. As crazy as that sounds, they were never big players. You know, the Yankees would outspend them all the time, and the Red Sox would tend to get their guys more in trade than free agency. And you know, there's some funny recollections of that time when Manny signed, and one of them was that, you know, ESPN did this Outside the Lines documentary where Jeff Mora, the agent for Manny Ramirez, let these cameras trail him around the entire negotiations. This was like for weeks at a time, and this special that they aired after Manny signed, you could hear all the phone calls with you know, Duquette and Morad and Manny and Duquette and all this kind of thing. And then so they get the deal done with Manny, and then all of a sudden Manny says he's only going to go if the Red Sox will hire Frank Mancini, the batting practice you know, clubhouse guy with Cleveland. Manny said that was the only way he would go. So Manny had this heartfelt conversation with Mancini, who said, look, Manny, I have family. I don't want to leave Cleveland. We have a house in Winter Haven, which is where the Indians train and spring train. So he broke the news to a crestfallen Manny Ramirez that he wouldn't be joining him in Boston. At first, Frank didn't think Manny was going to take the deal. And then Manny ends up going anyway. But it was just kind of a funny thing at the time. And Morad also said that this is the first free agent signing that ever happened over email. He did the whole thing with Duquette via email, and back in 2000, that was not quite as common as it is now, where, you know, business transactions taking place over email. Back then, people were still using fax machines, so it's kind of funny. That was sort of the start of the technology wave, too, where, you know, back then.
Now it's text messages. Forget email. We've moved on from that as well. So I guess that's the first instance right there up front of Manny being Manny, trying to bring the guy with him. I think it was big for the Red Sox, too, because everybody kind of assumed Manny, being from New York City, would end up with the Yankees, and the Red Sox came in and swooped him. You think back on Manny, and I said it, Manny being Manny was kind of the theme throughout his career, so many crazy things, but the one thing he always did was hit, and he was obviously a member of two World Series teams. He went out bad. Obviously, that final season was tough, but before that, I mean, here's a guy that rarely got hurt, always produced, and was always a lot of fun. There was no disappointment there, I think, for Red Sox fans.
Yeah, the one thing that kind of sticks out with Manny is, like, a lot of these big-name free agents who came to Boston, it was tough for him, the environment there. He wasn't ready for all the scrutiny and all that stuff. And, you know, I think just about once a year he would ask to be traded. But unlike Carl Crawford and, you know, John Lackey or, you know, David Price to a degree, he always, you know, the entire time he was there, he produced at an elite level. And, you know, as much as he might not have been thrilled to be in Boston sometimes, he always was able to, for those 3 hours he was on the field, he was able to put it all aside and put up, you know, huge numbers. So that's what I'll always remember about Manny Ramirez, is that nothing ever really faced him when he was in that batter's box.
Yeah, and 2004 certainly doesn't happen without Manny Ramirez, that's for sure. Some news and notes for the Red Sox over the last week since we've talked, Ian. Tyler Thornburg avoided arbitration, 1 year, $2.05 million. Obviously, they traded for him at the winter meetings a year ago. That didn't work out. He missed the whole season with injury. 2 years ago, they traded for Carson Smith at the winter meetings. He missed the whole season with injury. So hopefully they don't go that route to fill out the bullpen depth this year. Maybe free agency is the way to go. But Thornburg signs the one-year deal, avoiding the arbitration. At what point during 2018 do they hope he can come back and pitch?
Yeah, they're still waiting to feel that. I mean, he hasn't been ruled out yet for the start of the season, but maybe we'll find out more about where things are with Tyler Thornburg when we get to the winter meetings next week, and a lot of the times you get updates like that there. But, yeah, I mean, they're looking for him to have a bounce-back year. I mean, people forget he was supposed to be their primary setup guy last year, and now they have a pretty good bullpen even without him. So I think what they'll do is they'll do what they did with Carson Smith last year, and they'll be sort of conservative with him and not rush him back and make sure he's right when he does come back. And then you have, you know, you have Tyler Thornburg to go along with Smith and Matt Barnes, Joe Kelly, and, you know, some of these other guys, Brandon Workman. So you have the makings of a pretty good setup, because they would like to go out and get a lefty. So it'll be interesting to see if they can go out and do that.
Yeah, a lot of good arms down there, but yeah, as you said, a lot of right-handers as well. David Ortiz held his annual golf tournament down in the Dominican Republic. Hanley Ramirez was down there, and I guess feeling great after the surgery, I think he said, was the quote that he felt like they had taken out the part and replaced it with a new one, and he was good to go. That's great news for the Red Sox, because part of the issues with scoring runs last year, obviously, falls on the fact that Hanley had a down year.
Yeah, no, that would be huge. I mean, that's what I think that the Red Sox offense is going to surprise a lot of people next season, because everyone is sort of obsessing about, like, what their 2017 numbers were. Well, guys can be better than they were in 2017, and Hanley is top on that list. If he's feeling good, if he's getting full extension with his swing, maybe he has a year closer to what he had in 2016. Xander Bogaerts, I expect him to hit a lot better than he did last year. That was just a real down year for him. People forget he really messed up his hand. He got hit by a pitch in Tampa right before the All-Star break and wasn't really the same for the rest of the season. Mookie Betts is a guy whose numbers declined a little bit last year. He's 24 years old. He should keep getting better. Devers, are you going to get a full season of Devers next year? Benintendi, I think he's going to have as good a year as he had this year. I think he's going to have an even better year next year because, look, he had a couple really prolonged slumps in his rookie year, so if he can avoid those, you know, watch out for this guy. So I think that the Red Sox, you know, regardless of what they do, hopefully they make a couple additions here, but I think that they're going to hit more than people think in 2018.
All right, great stuff, Ian. Next time we do the podcast, we'll be together down there in Lake Buena Vista, Florida at the winter meetings. I'm looking forward to it. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Red Sox edition. For Ian Brown, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.